Tehran can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Experts are warning of the worst global food crisis since the Second World War. It is a crisis that will have its severest impacts on the poorest countries and poor people in relatively wealthy countries, especially those already experiencing food insecurity, says Richard Heinberg Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The energy and food crisis is far worse than most Americans realize." Stay tuned for more. Everyone who owns a gasoline burning car has noticed that fuel prices have shot up in recent weeks in the United States of America, and most of Americans have read headlines about high energy prices driving inflation in this country. But very few Americans have any inkling just how profound the current energy crisis already is and is about to become. This lack of awareness is partly due to economists, and those who depend on economists' readings of the tea leaves of Daily Dado, a group that sadly includes nearly all politicians and news purveyors. Recently, an NPR staff commentator confidentially stated, "The only way to get gasoline prices under control is to get inflation under control. Anyone who understands recent events and how economies work will immediately realize that the statement is backwards. Energy prices are rising for specific physical reasons, most of which are widely reported." Those higher prices show up in economic statistics as inflation, a phenomenon that economists equate to a malevolent miasma that occasionally drifts into the economy from a mysterious alternate dimension. Of course, the goal of raising interest rates is to cool demand, which theoretically should help lower prices. But if prices for a particular commodity are rising due to physical shortage caused by novel circumstances or events, rather than increasing demand, then higher interest rates may offer little relief while bringing serious unintended consequences of their own. The comparison with leeches still stands. There is already enough bloodletting going on in the world. What we need now is sound thinking based in physical reality. Let's start with symptoms and identify clear, understandable causes. Then we will explore the current extent of the energy crisis and its deeper societal implications, especially with regard to food. Finally, we will look at the energy crisis in the context of a broader, longer-term view of U.S. economic system and see what things the United States leaders could do that might actually improve the prospects of ordinary citizens and future generations. What's making energy more expensive? Simple, physical scarcity resulting from pandemic, war, and depletion. Let's unpack each of these causes. The economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic are old news, but they are keeping reverberating across the United States. A persistent worker shortage in the U.S., which you may have noticed at local restaurants, is also impacting energy companies and shipping firms. Further, the crash in oil demand early in the pandemic, when few people were driving to work, led to production cutbacks in the petroleum industry, notably in the United States of America, where fracking companies had been greedily burning through investor cash for years. Now demand has recovered, but investors are wary, and so companies are slow to drill wells likely to prove unprofitable. Raising interest rates, which will make it more expensive for oil companies to borrow money to fund operations, certainly won't increase the flow of oil and gas. The energy impacts of the Russian military operation in Ukraine are likewise straightforward and widely reported. Looming back of every other aspect of the oil supply story is depletion. If there is a shortage of oil, why not just open the spigots in other nations to make up the shortfall? Unfortunately, it's not that simple. OPEC's tired oil wells are about half depleted following decades of continuous extraction. Increasing the rate of pumping at this point would damage reservoirs, reducing the amount ultimately recoverable. The owners and managers of those oil fields are understandably reluctant to jeopardize their patrimony, and they're relishing the higher prices their product is selling for. So OPEC has barely nudged its output in response to shortages brought on by the war. The other potential source of increased supply is the U.S., whose tight oil extraction rates have soared in recent years. But most of the geological formations that have been the source of this bonanza, such as the Bakken in North Dakota, are already in irreversible decline due to depletion. The world as a whole saw its peak output of conventional petroleum in 2016, following a long plateau that began in 2005. Oil importers, therefore, are largely out of options for replacing those lost barrels. Energy is essential for everything we do. It's not just a part of the economy. In a real physical sense, it is the economy. Therefore, whenever there is an energy crisis, it can quickly become an everything crisis. The links between energy and the economy are perhaps at their most transparent when it comes to diesel fuel. Trucks, trains, and tractors burn diesel. Therefore, when diesel gets scarce, supply chains start to seize up and food prices climb. Shipping costs were already soaring before the Russia-Ukraine military operation. Now, diesel shortages are erupting in South Africa, Sri Lanka, and Europe. Passenger trains in India have been idled. Thousands of buses, trucks, and cars in Cameroon have been stranded for weeks without fuel. In Sri Lanka, high energy and food prices have just helped bring down a government. At the start of May, inventories of diesel on the U.S. East Coast plunged to lowest seasonal level since government records began more than 3 decades ago. Wholesale and retail diesel prices hit all-time highs. Among the millions of trucks that run on diesel are Amazon.com's roughly 70,000 delivery vans and semi-trucks. That company just announced a disappointing quarter and outlook due to largely to higher costs for trucking packages to customers. Most of Americans don't really care much whether Amazon turns a profit. But Jeff Bezos' current woes are echoed throughout industry after industry. Even companies whose business model doesn't include physical delivery of goods still depend on other companies that burn diesel. That's partly why global stock markets have recently seen massive sell-offs. But the market has yet to fully internalize the nearly existential risk posed by declining energy. The signs of energy crisis are everywhere. In Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, airlines recently threatened to cancel virtually all flights in response to surging kerosene prices. U.S. retail gasoline prices just hit a new record. And Europe is preparing for the likelihood of several natural gas shortages next winter. Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdul Aziz bin Salman, speaking at the World Utilities Congress in Abu Dhabi in early May, said, "The world needs to wake up. The world is running out of energy capacity at all levels. It's a reality." One may question the motives of the Saudi minister. A so-called NOPEC bill making its way through the U.S. Congress would make it possible to sue OPEC cartel for price fixing. So the Saudis might like to heighten the perception that they are providing the world with an increasingly scarce good. Nevertheless, the statement is clear, direct, and supported by abundant evidence. If tractor fuel is getting more expensive, you might think that will put pressure on food prices, and you'd be right. But that's only one reason the cost of food is skyrocketing. Nitrogen fertilizer made from natural gas is seeing unprecedented price hikes, largely as a result of Eastern Europe crisis. In response, farmers everywhere are preparing to test the limits of how little fertilizer they can apply without threatening yields. Forecasts are bleak. For West Africa, reduced fertilizer use is projected to shrink this year's rice and corn harvest by a third. Costa Rica would see coffee output falling as much as 15% next year if farmers reduce their fertilizer application by one-third. For many years, organic and ecological agriculture advocates have argued that the world could produce just as much food without resorting to fossil fuel-based fertilizers and pesticides. But their alternative methods require knowledge and time for transition. Going cold turkey on fertilizer without planning and preparation would almost certainly lead to sharply lower yields over the short term. In response, the EU is now delaying rules intended to reduce farming's environmental impacts, including curbs on pesticide use. It also aims to put 4 million hectares of fallow land into cultivation. In sum, experts are warning of the worst global food crisis since the Second World War. It is a crisis that will have its severest impacts on the poorest countries and poor people in relatively wealthy countries, especially those already experiencing food insecurity. There will also likely be compounding social and political consequences, as pointed out in a new report by risk consultancy Verisk Malcroft, which notes that middle-income countries such as Brazil and Egypt will be particularly at risk for rising civil unrest.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanahu.
We have two kinds of path, the path of truth and the path of Satan. These are the two paths. Either it is the path of faith and Islam, submission, where attention is given toward divine teachings and man's relation is with Allah. Allah surely guides the believers and makes all their strivings for Him on condition that they come upon this path. Or then there is the path of unbelief, which is contrary or opposite to the path of oneness of Allah. On one side, right and left, are Satan's or Taghut, which end up in hell.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, he mentions that now our condition is such that, God forbid, any wrong move we take will be ascribed to Islam. Now, he is referring to the actions of those who are, for example, they have reached to a status, who are the leaders, for example, if they are the community leaders, if they are the ones who are known as religious or practicing Muslims in the society, who are active in a mosque or maybe a Husseiniyah. So Imam says that, today is a place where when people look at us, when people see us, and if they see any wrong thing from us, they ascribe it to Islam. And this is something wrong because this is my personal action. Therefore, I need to be very much careful because I cannot say that the practice that I have been doing or the things that I have done, it's my own actions. Because those who are outside, who are looking at us from outside, they see us as a practicing Muslim. They see whatever we do as the eyes of Islam, as the practices of Islam. Therefore, we need to be very much careful when we perform something, when we say something. If this thing that I'm doing and it has nothing to do with Islam, it is not related to Islam, then I should make clear to the people that this is my own actions. This has nothing to do with Islam.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu alayhi.
Generally, when we see people, they're practicing, they don't do that. They do not mention that this is nothing to do with Islam. They just practice, they just perform things, and everything is being end up on the name of Islam. Therefore, we need to be careful what we do. And therefore, it also brings upon us a compulsion of practicing Islam and living according to the true teachings of Islam and following the true teachings of Islam, so that whatever we perform, people can see what Islam is all about and what Islam teaches and what Islam talks about. Therefore, we need to be very much careful when we are performing the actions and when we are saying something, when we are dealing with the people, and we need to observe justice as it is said in the Islam, to observe justice, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime will not pursue a criminal investigation into the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aqile, whose death earlier this month sparked global outrage. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Andrea Germanos, journalist. This article is published under the heading Zionist regime says no criminal probe into killing of journalist Shirin Abu Aqile. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime will not pursue a criminal investigation into the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aqile, whose death earlier this month sparked global outrage. The development was reported recently by both Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post, Zionist regime's newspapers. Abu Aqile, Al Jazeera's correspondent in Palestine, was fatally shot by a Zionist sniper in the head on May 11th. While covering an Israeli regime raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. She was wearing a helmet and press jacket. Witnesses say she was shot by an Israeli regime troop. In view of the nature of the operational activity, which included intense fighting and extensive exchanges of fire, it was decided that there was no need to open a military police investigation at this stage, according to a statement from the military provided to the Jerusalem Post. Israeli-based human rights organization B'Tselem suggested the announcement from the military police criminal investigation division should come as no surprise. B'Tselem tweeted, as B'Tselem has stated again and again, no one should wait for Israel's investigations nor accept that they will deliver justice for Palestinians. It is time for the world to finally wake up to this reality and take action. Anything else simply enables Israel's impunity. In a statement to Al Jazeera, Abu Aqile's family said, "We were expecting this from the Israeli side. We urge the United States in particular, since she is a U.S. citizen, and the international community to open a just and transparent investigation and to put an end to the killings," the family said. The Intercept reported recently that a pair of congressional Democrats, representatives Andre Carson of Indiana and Lou Correa of California, are gathering signatures for a letter demanding an FBI investigation into Abu Aqile's killing and a determination from the State Department as to whether U.S. laws were violated. Days after Abu Aghla's death, global outrage erupted after footage showed the Zionist regime forces attacking the pallbearers of her coffin during the funeral procession. The footage of that violence was shocking, said United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet, who called for accountability for the terrible killing, not just of Shirin Abu Aghla, but for all the killings and serious injuries in the occupied Palestinian territory. A group of leading artists similarly called recently for full accountability for the perpetrators of Abu Aghla's death and everyone involved in authorizing it. In an open letter, figures including Spanish film director Pedro Almodovar, Indian author Aranti Roy, Canadian author Naomi Klein, and the U.S. actor Mark Ruffalo write, "We call on our governments to end hypocrisy and to act with consistency in the application of international law and human rights. We call on them to take meaningful measures to ensure accountability for the killing of Shirin Abu Aghla and all other Palestinian civilians." They add, "There must be no double standards when it comes to the basic human rights to freedom from persecution and oppression and in the right to life and to dignity."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Brothers and sisters, if we wish to live a felicitous life and a better life in this world and in the hereafter, we need to seek closeness to Allah. We need to achieve closeness to Allah. This world is created to enable us to achieve perfection, follow our spiritual journey, and attain closeness to Allah, attain proximity to Allah. This world is the place of test, imtihan. And although Allah has created everything for us and created us to test us, these are only means for the existence of real human beings. This is just like the example of a school. Everything, including classes, chairs, and blackboards, are created for the students in that school. Students are asked to try their best to pass exams successfully. But this in itself is not important. Only those good students who pass the exams successfully actualize the hope and aim of the school makers or the educational staff. The Holy Quran says, الَّذِي خَلَقَ الْمَوْتَ وَالْحَيَاةَ لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا وَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الْغَفُورُ. This verse of the Holy Quran, verse 2 of chapter 67, says that Allah created death and life so that He may try you, that He may test you, which of you is best in your deeds, and which of you is better in terms of actions and performance. And Allah is mighty, He is forgiving. So, we understand from this verse that this world is the world where we are tested, where we are put to test. And of course, we need to be successful, just like a student who must work hard in order to good marks and achieve excellent results. We, as God's servants, should also work hard to achieve the ultimate goal for which we have been created. Only those people who are good and who have good deeds and who perform good deeds are primarily intended. There are many verses in the Holy Quran in which Allah touches on the concept, on the goal of human creation. وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. And I have not created the jinn and the man except to serve me. So, servitude, serving Allah, is one of the purposes for which we have been created. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
God is definitely needless. He does not need us to worship Him. But we have been created to be tested. Who is going to be obedient? Because Allah has provided us with every blessing, with every, you know, bounty that we need, and every means for achieving perfection. So we have to be grateful to Allah. We have to be thankful to Allah. And thankfulness is a duty that we have to fulfill. If someone gives you a hand, or if someone helps you, you thank him for his assistance, for his help, for reaching out to you. Imagine God has created this world. God has given us everything that we need in our daily life. And if we are not thankful to Allah, if we are ungrateful to Allah, imagine, it is a kind of, this act of ingratitude angers Allah. So we have to worship Allah. And worship means that we have to be thankful to Allah. We have to glorify Him for His blessings. مَا أُرِيدُ مِنْهُمْ مِنْ رِزْقٍ وَمَا أُرِيدُ أَنْ يُتْعِمُونَ. Allah says that I do not desire from the human beings, from them, any sustenance, and I do not desire that they should feed me. إِنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الرَّزَاقُ ذُو الْقُوَّةِ الْمَتِينَ. Allah is the bestower of sustenance. He does not need to be provided for. Allah is needless. He is self-sufficient. And Allah is the bestower of sustenance. He is the Lord of power, the strong. ذُو الْقُوَّةِ الْمَتِينَ. Dear brothers and sisters, Allah wants us to worship Him. Worship means that actually we need to know Him. We cannot worship Allah unless we know Him. And of course, through worshiping Allah, we get close to Him. The phrase لِيَعْبُدُونَ is interpreted as لِيَعْرِفُونَ.
meaning that I have created man only to know me. وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ So لِيَعْبُدُونَ According to some exegetes, according to some interpreters of the Holy Quran, means لِيَعْرِفُونَ, means to know Allah. And of course, this fact can also be understood from another verse, verse 12 of chapter 65. There is a divine saying, a hadith Qudsi also, which is very famous among the scholars, among the exegetes. That hadith Qudsi says, كُنْتُ كَنْزًا مَخْفِيًّا فَأَحْبَبْتُ أَنْ أُعْرَفْ فَخَلَقْتُ الْخَلْقَ لِكَيْ أُعْرَفْ I was a hidden secret. I was an unknown treasure. So I like to be known. فَأَحْبَبْتُ أَنْ أُعْرَفْ I like to be known. Therefore, I created man to be known. فَخَلَقْتُ الْخَلْقَ لِكَيْ أُعْرَفْ This is the aim of worshipping Allah, the aim of knowing Allah is, of course, to get closer to Allah, to achieve perfection, and getting closer and achieving proximity to Allah is definitely the ultimate goal for which man has been created.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam in the prayer of Arafah, Du'a-i Arafah says, إلهي علمت باختلاف الآثار وتنقلات الأطوار أن مرادك مني أن تتعرف إلي في كل شيء حتى لا أجهلك في شيء O Allah, through the variety of your signs in the world and in the changes in the states and conditions, I found that the purpose is to make yourself known to me in everything so that I would not ignore you in anything. This is, of course, one of the highest levels of perfection for man. To know Allah in everything. This recalls to mind or brings to our mind what Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam said, مَا رَأَيْتُ شَيْءٍ إِلَّا وَقَدْ رَأَيْتُ اللَّهَ قَبْلَهُ وَبَعْدَهُ وَمَعَهُ I did not see anything except that I saw Allah before it and with it and after it. So this is the highest level of divine knowledge. This is the highest level of knowledge of Allah. And it's achievable, but we need to work hard for it. And of course, the more perfection we achieve, the more knowledge we gain, the closer we are to Allah. Those people who are the perfect men, Insani Kamil, are really the goal of the creation. In a divine saying, Allah says to the Prophet, لَوْلَاكْ لَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْأَفْلَاكُ If you were not there, I would not create the world. This is a saying to the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, لَوْلَاكْ لَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْأَفْلَاكِ If you were not there, I would not create the world. I would not create the universe. I would not create the constellations and everything. The perfect man or woman actualizes the goal. Perfection is nothing but closeness to Allah and receiving His pleasure, the pleasure of Allah. Because Allah is the most perfect being and the source of all values and goods. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is said to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, this is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly, in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threat, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has visited Albania. Officially, the trip was meant to celebrate the centenary of U.S.-Albania diplomatic relations. But Pompeo's stance against Iran manifested itself after he went to the camp of a notorious terrorist cult there. Pompeo held a meeting with the leaders of the Mujahideen-e Khalq, or MKO, terrorist cult. Encouraged by the presence of terrorists there, Pompeo repeated his anti-Iran rant, expressing his long unfulfilled wish to see the Islamic Republic overthrown. The former CIA chief said that under the leadership of infamous Maryam Rajavi, the MKO has been laying the groundwork for what he called a, quote, free, sovereign, democratic republic of Iran.
The recent visit of Mike Pompeo to Albania is in a way a revitalization of the old connections that Mike Pompeo has with Israeli Mossad and the Iranian Mujahideens, who are terrorists.
Pompeo is not part of the current U.S. administration, but his rhetoric and deeds indeed reflect the deep-seated animosity of the U.S. establishment towards Iran and its government. During his tenure as the U.S. Secretary of State between 2018 and 2021 in the Trump administration, Pompeo and other belligerent politicians around him, most notably former National Security Advisor John Bolton, expressed an open secret regarding Washington's stance towards MKO terrorist cult. Pompeo and his team became the MKO sponsors in his delusional attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Back then, the regime in Washington left no stone unturned to topple Iran, but failed miserably in the hysteric anti-Iran drive.
Pompeo was paid probably more than $150,000 for his visit to the Mujahideen camp.
Mujahideen-e Khalq is a terrorist cult which is now based at a camp in Albania. The MKO regularly hosts big events in which top American and European officials make speeches in support of the group.
They run a paramilitary camp in the town of Manza in the region of Durrës in Albania. From Manza, the Mujahideens, they carry hostile and terrorist activities against Iran, but even against political Islam in general.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, and former Director of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency, Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, are amongst the top officials that have attended the group's events. The terrorist cult has been accused of being involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. The MKO was formally designated as a terrorist group around the world, but the United States and the Europeans delisted it in recent years amid growing strains in ties with Tehran. The terrorist group also fought alongside Iraqi forces in the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's war on Iran in the 1980s. Prior to that, it killed thousands of ordinary Iranians and officials, the number said to be in the tens of thousands. Support for anti-Iran terrorist groups in the US and Europe has remarkably grown in the Western countries, with many Western spy agencies actively involved in aiding and arming them.
Well, the U.S. government has a long history of cooperating with terrorist organizations. Nowadays, we have many countries in the Middle East who complain from the U.S. support for different terrorist groups.
The Islamic Republic has already warned Europeans that their support for the MKO will be costly for them. Tehran has condemned the hosting of the group by Albania and is delisting by the U.S. and Europe.
On Saturday, a gunman attacked a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and injuring 3 others. Most of the victims were African American, making the attack one of the deadliest racially charged mass shootings in the United States' recent history. According to the police, the detained suspect, identified as 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, drove over 200 miles to carry out the attack. The law enforcement also said they were reviewing a 180-page document published online detailing the gunman's motivations. In the so-called manifesto, the author describes themselves as a white supremacist concerned about, quote, the dwindling white population. The document also says that he chose the area for the attack as its zip code has a large black population, which was within the driving distance of where he lived.
the inability of the unsustainability of neoliberal capitalism. So there's less resources, there's scarcity, there's a job market is being affected. Everyone is affected by that, but their interpretation of what the problem is different. And for white extremists, white supremacist extremists, they blame immigrants, they blame black people, they blame. And so you're seeing these ideologies that are emerging, or mentalities, or not emerging. They've always existed, but they're responding to the intensification of the logical conclusions of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism, austerity, joblessness, you know, privatization, all of that.
The police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, as an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The teenager faces first-degree murder, a charge he has pleaded not guilty to. Among the victims were a father who was buying a birthday cake for his 3-year-old son, and Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old woman who was known for her civil rights advocacy. The tragic irony is that almost a year ago, she had written a letter to a local newspaper calling for stricter gun control measures. The Buffalo mass shooter managed to live stream his attack on a popular streaming service using camera gear mounted on his military helmet. Although the feed was taken down soon after it began, the issue reignited criticisms about the moderation of social media platforms. It bore striking similarities with the 2019 terrorist attack on two mosques in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand that killed 51 people. That attack was also streamed live on social media. The incident in Buffalo is considered the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. so far this year. But some 200 other mass shootings were carried out since the beginning of January. Unofficial data suggests that over 320 people are shot in the U.S. every day. A recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that gun violence in the country rose dramatically in 2020, with homicides involving firearms surging by 35%, the highest level in 25 years. The report points to disparities in the rates of homicide based on race, ethnicity, and poverty. The study fails to single out the specific reason for such inequality, but cites the COVID-19 pandemic as a possible socioeconomic driving factor.
People having to seek their own interpretations of what's happening. We're seeing it like things like this shooting, and this is not the only shooting. There's other things that are happening where people are acting out, trying to figure out, you know, just acting out, reactionary, the most extreme reactionary responses to what's happening. And it can only get worse. As long as capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy are the rule of the day in the United States, they can't address the fundamental human needs of people, then things like this will get worse. And then as the media glosses over it and doesn't want to tell people the truth, they can only get worse.
Tragic incidents like these are a grim reminder of the need for tighter gun control laws that would prevent easy access to firearms and reforms that would rid the U.S. society of racial and ethnic biases.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the U.S. and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views U.S. military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The U.S. is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil. Missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
The United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islamite, Allah my Lord, His word Quran, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet, Muhammad Prophet, praise be upon, praise be upon, I am Muslim for all of time.
You know how, like, especially the past decade-ish, specifically with the advent of social media, you get these like hashtag healthy lifestyle, hashtag vegan lifestyle, hashtag keto lifestyle, hashtag whatever the fudge lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
Yeah. And I look at them and I feel like I'm not sure. Maybe veganism can be practiced as a lifestyle to an extent where, you know, you don't use leather in your clothing, you don't use any animal parts in your tools and instrument, whether you're a musician or whatever, in your food. And that encompasses more than one aspect of your life, leading it to become an overall lifestyle for you to an extent that's more understandable. But it's a keto lifestyle. I definitely don't understand. You just got a keto diet. Mm-hmm. You don't got a keto lifestyle, right? And then there's Islamic lifestyle.
True.